Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 560. And I've got an amazing guest today in Wumi Masaku. Any of you who heard my TV shows of the year episode only recently, like we did it late, a bit into the year for last year, will know that Wumi, or might know that Wumi, came up in two of my shows of the year last year and has been in many more. So I was incredibly excited for this conversation. You might know Wumi from Lovecraft Country, from Loki, from a million things. But they've got a new show out called Passenger on ITVX, and it's fantastic. And we talk about that a lot, but we talk about numerous other things as well. Scavenger's Reign is another series that Wumi's in that's one of my favourite shows of all time. But we get into all of that. This is a great conversation. I was really moved by how open Wumi was with some really heavy subjects that we get into. So yeah, I think you're going to love this. And then you're going to love everything they've ever been in. As said, Passenger, Scavenger's Reign, Loki, Lovecraft Country, all get huge recommendations from me. His House is another, like, an amazing film that came out a few years back on Netflix. Yeah, we are brought to you as ever by speechdevelopmentrecords.com. Head over there and you can get all sorts of merch and support the podcast. And while I'm speaking of such things, multiple time guest, my touring companion, and someone I've shared the mic on numerous tracks and stages, B Dolan, has got the pre-order for their new record out, The Wound Is Not the Body. You can pre-order on Bandcamp. You can pre-order on B's websites. Yeah, honestly, this album is astounding. I've been lucky enough to hear it. So go and get involved in that. If for 1 week only you want to forget speechdevelopmentrecords.com and head over to B Dolan's website, then maybe get involved in that. We're also brought to you by patreon.com/ScroobiusPipio, where you can support the podcast and those who work behind the scenes for like $1 or $2 a month. And twitch.tv/ScroobiusPipio. I recently did a big stream on there going over my recent trip to Malaysia. So you can catch that on VOD. It's like in the old days when your mum and dad's mate had come over after their holiday and do a slideshow of their trip. It's like that, but on Twitch. So check that out, twitch.tv/ScroobiusPipio. Other than that, I mean, we may as well jump into the podcast. This is, as I said, a hell of a chat. It's the first time we'd met. And genuinely, there was a couple of times I was really moved by how open Wumi was. So yeah, as you can hear, I'm a big fan of them and their work. And that was only increased by this conversation. So I hope you enjoy it too. This is episode 560 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Wumi Masaku. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. I hate it when there's kind of homework to do before an interview. It's never nice. It's not what I'm here for. But I'm here today with Wumi Masaku. How's everything going? How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really excited to chat to you. And I'm going to warn you in advance, I think you're really, really good. So this is going to be a long conversation that's littered with praise all along the way. Brace yourself for that, frankly, because you were in two of my favourite shows of 2023 and numerous other things I loved, and I'm intrigued, like having seen the first two episodes of Passenger. So let's kind of start around there, because it's the first thing I've seen you in a while with a British accent, I guess, and you grew up in Manchester, right?
Yeah, grew up in Manchester.
What was it like up there when you were growing up? What kind of kid were you? What were you into?
What kind of a kid was I? I would say I was a good kid, as in I never got into like serious trouble, but my teachers would have found me a pain in the bum. My mum found me a pain in the bum too. I was just like high energy, lots of chat back, lots of questions, but ultimately I did my homework. Well, did I do my homework? I did my exams and I passed my GCSEs and my A-levels and all that stuff. But was I like an A student in some things that I enjoyed? Yes. With the right teacher? Yes. With the wrong teacher? No. You know, I was just kind of like, I was a kid that was very much like, if you give me the right energy, I think this is with every kid. If you give the kid respect and energy, they'll give you respect and energy back. And if you don't, they don't. So it depends on the teacher you spoke to. You know what I mean? Like,
Completely. Did you have anyone at that point that encouraged your acting? Because I remember speaking years ago to Riz Ahmed, and he clearly remembers just one person encouraging his acting as a kid, and that starting it all off. And as you were saying there, if the right people give you the right feedback and interaction, it can make such a huge difference on your whole life, really. Like, if your maths teacher is really enthusiastic, it could take you any direction.
It's true. My maths teacher was very enthusiastic, and I nearly did maths at university.
Love it.
But my drama teachers, I would say at high school, it would be Tom Wells. Mm-hmm. He was just dead passionate about storytelling and Shakespeare. And he just kind of accepted me as who I was, knowing I wasn't a bad kid. And like, he would talk to me about like how was my behavior in other classes and stuff, but he never he never wrote me off. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then I had Rob Faulkner and Wynne Moran at college. And those two, I think, is when it was a real like turning point for me to take it seriously. They were just so passionate and they really believed in me. And I really struggled with English. So like A-levels, like essays and all that stuff, I was very much like, oh, I'll just do the practical exam. I won't turn up to the written exam. And because there's no point, because I'd been told the whole life that I was bad at English. And they were just really, they really begged me to not do that. And in the end, I got a B. And like, if I didn't do that, I would have failed my drama GCSE and my drama A level. So that was really great. And, you know, for me, the drama studio was the only place that I actually found peace. Like growing up, like I found college quite stressful and I found high school quite stressful. And I started getting insomnia and anxiety a bit. And I found myself like, and that sounds like bad, but I found myself that the drama studio at my college was like the only place I really could relax and could even get some kipping and all that stuff. Like, I really felt like it was a safe little haven. So that was like, those three teachers were instrumental for me.
I love that. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful to hear that they could convince you in that right direction. But then it also makes me sad that we can't have an education system that can mold to focus on the strengths. If these are your strengths, it should be focusing on getting the most out of that rather than going, look, again, it sounds like your teachers were perfect going, look, you've got to do this bit as well. It's not the bit you're going to enjoy. It's not your strength, but you'll fail otherwise. But how great would it have been if they could have gone, all right, forget that. Like, let's focus on this bit that you're passionate about and really nurture the most of that.
But the truth is, like, I'm dyslexic and reading is really hard for me.
Yeah.
But I do have to read every day for my job. Mm-hmm. So even though I don't, there's parts of it that I'm not strong at. Like, it takes me a long time to read a script. And there are parts of it that with the way my brain works, that bit's hard, but actually learning lines is quite easy for me. And there's a yin and yang. It's like, you know, there's the unemployment of being an actor and then the employment is, it's part of the whole job. Do you know what I mean? There's the bit that feels like a job and there's the bit that feels like a vocation. And I think we forget that all art comes with a bit of like the job that we hate. But we're just lucky enough that we get the art that we enjoy too. Do you know what I mean?
I completely know what you mean. And it's really interesting to see with different things like dyslexia or different neurodivergences, how we can turn that into a strength rather than a hurdle or a restriction. I've got a few friends who are dyslexic who I've been on sets with and we've gone through lines in their trailer and done a lot more there. And I genuinely feel they're amazing actors because the lines spend less time on paper and exist more time out spoken out loud, and or at least even if it's only in their heads, it's more it's ruminating in their heads more than just being this thing on a bit of paper. And again, it can be this amazing strength and power there, and it's finding ways to remove the hurdles and focus on the on the advantages there.
That's so true. Remove the hurdles. Yeah, like for me, blue paper, having my script on blue paper.
Really?
World of difference.
Simple as that. Wow.
World of difference, you know, like turning my phone to dark mode, mm-hmm. my computer to dark mode, world of difference. And you just don't really get that kind of specialized figuring it out at school. Like,
yeah.
Here's me reading lots of stuff on white paper in a white room with bright lights, like my eyes just like shut down, my brain shut down. And I was like, I can't do this anymore. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was so stressful for me. And that's every single class.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
That's fascinating, isn't it? And again, I think the pandemic kind of showed us how much can be done when we have to adapt. Like, and there's so many things where we don't adapt things because, oh, no, it's not going to help that many people or whatever. But it's like, well, no, that, again, how many kids haven't followed the right path because they were stuck by that? It was too much to overcome, you know?
It's a
tough one. So you went to a drama school, and then, like, I talk about this a lot on here, so we don't have to dwell on it too much, but I love that in the UK in particular, we kind of almost have a TV apprenticeship in shows like The Bill, Holby. Like, almost every British actor I have on has come through either a Holby or a The Bill or an EastEnders or a Doctors or any of these shows. So how was that as your kind of route? Is it kind of a good working, like a work experience kind of thing? Like, how do you find those
Absolutely.
Things?
Absolutely. Yeah, those things are brilliant and so necessary. And, you know, that you grow up on them and it feels like you're a little boost of confidence that the Bill wants you or Holby wants you. Like, it's a boost and it gives you a little bit of confidence. I don't know. For me, I remember when the Bill came through and I was like, or I could have done like a 2-week play somewhere. And obviously it was like, in my head, I wanted to be like, I wanted to do theatre. And then I was like, you know what? I really should get some practicing, but it was just exactly the same week, the same 2 weeks that I was needed. And I was like, let me do that. And I learned so much on the Bill that in those 2 weeks. Like, you get TV and film training at drama school, but it's literally, I mean, they go through the jobs of everyone, like the list of everyone on the jobs, and I still don't know everyone's title. Do you know what I mean? On a film set, I know what they do, but I don't know their title. But for some reason, that's part of your training at drama school. And I mean, completely necessary. I don't think if I didn't do the Bill and Doctors, I don't think I would have got Moses Jones.
Yeah,
as simple as that. Like, and that was the beginning of my relationship with the BBC. And I honestly don't think I would have.
Yeah, it's amazing how important those things are. And as you say, getting that experience of being on set and seeing how the turnover is and what the pressure is, where you sit comfortably in that world is amazing. Well, jumping all the way forward, and we will go back and forth a lot. Talk to me about A Passenger, because it's, you know, your character is a very different police officer to most of the ones in The Bill. But yeah, it seemed like a lot of fun to play, because straight off the bat, you're boxing, you're sleuthing, you're going off track. It seems like a great character. How was it?
Really fun. I really loved playing Ria. I think, I always say this, and it sounds really, I don't know, it might sound a bit pretentious, but I always, when I read the script, I felt like Marsha in Three Sisters, I'm in mourning for my life. That line, I mean, in one of the translations that I've seen or whatever, I'm like, I'm in mourning for my life. And that kept coming back to me for Ria. I'm in mourning for my life, like, kind of stuck. And she can move, she can leave, but she can't. And I don't know why. And I was like, why is she still here? And that was just really interesting to me to figure out the why. And, you know, I think there's a part of her that likes to be a big fish in a small pond.
Yeah.
She's up from the Met Police and she's been there, done it all. Like, she's legit a detective, but she's in this small town and she's dealing with Cat with a cough and a missing ladder. She's so frustrated, but also too scared to do anything about it.
Yeah.
You know, But then there's also something about Chadder that she's like, I can't quite put my finger on it. And I think also that's part of the reason why she can't leave either. She's like, there is more to this town than meets the eye. There's more to these people, this uniformed kind of homogenous kind of mentality, this small town.
Yeah,
I don't know. I think she's so frustrated and scared and intrigued and stubborn.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I love it. I love the level of mystery in your own head on it all. Again, I think a lot of people do their work on a character, they'll often try and explain everything, yet that's not our real lives. I live in the same small town I've lived in my whole life. When people ask me, I'm like, I don't know. It's just where I am. It's like, oh, is it really lovely there? It's like, nah, it's not
just great, where I live.
But it's just where I live. Like, there's no big explanation. Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure I could find out through a lot of therapy sessions. But yeah, realistically, there's a lot of stuff we don't know the motivations for our choices. So yeah.
But even like the fact that staying where you're from isn't strange.
Yeah.
Like, it's not strange. It's just like, I'm here.
Which is kind of strange. Like, the fact it isn't strange is strange. with the amount of places we could go, like what's the chance we're going to have been born in the place that we're meant to be? You know, the amount of options, it's, everything's that's strange. Funny.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's an interesting way of thinking about it.
I mean, speaking of which, what happens in this small town is you find yourself dealing with a series of unnatural crimes. So how was that to kind of, again, take on this project that isn't just a kind of, because something the British do, I think, amazingly, but may I say sometimes too often, is just crime dramas. Like, we love a crime drama. We can't get enough of a crime drama. And again, it's because there's so many amazing ones, but still it is like there's other things that we can do. It's like when we had decades of only doing period dramas and it's like, cool, you're really good at that, man, but how about something else? So the exciting thing here is that it's not just a crime drama. It's a supernatural crime that's going on, but it is set in a very small and real town, if you know what I mean. It's not some big crazy sci-fi, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I totally get you about, and I was nervous when Andy approached me about a police officer. I was like, could she be anything other than a police officer? But, there wasn't anything normal about the script, even the crime from the beginning, like cat with a cough, missing ladder.
Yeah,
that was like, it's like, this isn't regular. This definitely isn't regular. And then
I'm two episodes in and I don't really know what the crimes are. It's all kind of very confusing.
Well,
there's a lot of kind of, some stuff's happening, but
yeah. And like, people in Chadder want to brush it all off, right? Brush it under the carpet. It's nothing. It's a dead stag. It's a dead stag. Well, no, it's not a dead stag. It's a stag in bits.
Yeah.
But that's the other thing. It's not supernatural. It's not. It's unnatural.
Unnatural.
But it's not supernatural.
Yeah.
It's all very real, but all very weird.
Yeah.
So I don't know when this is going to air.
I guess we're avoiding spoilers still, but yeah.
Yeah. The last few minutes of episode one, I was like, huh? Yeah. So what is this about?
It's kind of the setting of a small town is kind of beautiful, though, and the grounding of it, because it's weird how much we will just accept because it's the real world and it's not a TV show. If something really odd happens in your town, you'd be like, oh, that's weird, but there's probably an explanation, and you kind of move on. It probably all makes sense. A lot has to happen to make you go, no, hang on, this isn't quite right.
Yeah, and that's really what Andy was like, sold me on. He was like, he told me a story about someone coming back from holiday and, oh, actually, I probably shouldn't share his story because it's his story.
sure.
But like, some things like really different and everyone's like, oh, everything's all right. Nothing.
Yeah.
Like, whoa.
Yeah.
It's everything's different.
When I worked in retail for years, me and a mate of mine would regularly bring in our favourite local newspaper stories, because it'll just be the weirdest stuff that's like, oh, this has happened. someone's found this. It's like, oh, cool. Is this not the front page? This is just the strangest
That's
thing in the
so
world.
Funny. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, speaking of the unnatural, one of my TV shows of last year, which actually I spoke about in a recent episode, but it's not been released over here, was Scavenger's Reign. It absolutely, it blew me away. How was that to work on? Have you done much kind of voice and animation-y type stuff before?
No, I haven't. That was a really nice surprise offer that came in. And I had spoken to my team about doing voiceover work. Mm. I think the pandemic made me go, oh, wow, like, you know, actually, you know, lots of people have different strings to their bow, and I feel like I've just got the one. let me branch out.
Yeah.
I loved it. I just was like, I didn't have the whole script, the whole story or anything.
Yeah.
They just give you your lines and then the breakdown. And then I'd go into the studio and they would show me what they'd already kind of drawn and whatever, and the scenes before and after. And I was like, this is cool. I loved it. I really enjoyed doing that. Like, really enjoyed it. Like, definitely want to, like, it inspired me to get a voiceover agent and all that stuff. Because I was like, I'd like to do more of this.
It's amazing because this industry in general is very collaborative. You go and do your bit, and then at some point later, you kind of get to find out if it's good or not. you kind of get to see. But that's even more so in a thing like this. So how was it when it all kind of, or when you got to see it all come to life? Because for those who haven't seen it, like the depictions it gives of alien life, I thought were just astounding. And it's kind of weaving a narrative of a crew that have crashed on and been scattered on an alien planet, but it feels like it's mixed with what I imagine it would look like if David Attenborough did a documentary on on an alien planet. Like, it's this the most beautiful and unique and weird documents of life forms, and all in this great story of separation and potential survival.
The animation on it is so unique and beautiful, and I was surprised to be kind of grossed out by some of the things. I was like, wow, I've never watched something and go, ooh, like an animation.
Yeah.
Like, I've never done that. And I was just really impressed by these guys, like their imagination and but the style. Yeah, it was just so different. And sorry, I don't know if I
love it. No, that's perfect. As said, it's the kind of show that, I'd finish each episode like, just, exactly what you said there. Just, this has been a trip.
Yeah. Who thought of that? How did they,
all of the way, all the plants and animals, just everything they do, it's like,
the ecosystem.
This is, mind blowing. Well, another thing that blew my mind in recent years was Loki. And I think it's possibly my favourite of the Marvel shows. Just the writing from Bishop and everyone else was just astounding. Kate Herron kind of bringing it all to life so amazingly. How was it to step into like a franchise that big? Like, it's the biggest franchise there is, basically, right? It's Marvel.
Yeah, it was nerve-wracking. I was definitely like, don't freak out. You belong here. And then, you know, I walked in and Tom Hiddleston's like, Wands! You know, we went to drama school together.
Oh, really? I didn't even know that. Oh, that's amazing.
And then Gugu was there, and she wasn't there when I was there, but we've met through the whole RADA, like, tiny little world. So it was like, Tom, Gugu, hi! And then it felt really easy to do the read through, like, you know, that fear, like there's that fear because you hear the rumors, especially in America, that you do a read through and you get fired, like people get fired. And so, like, I was still very anxious about that because obviously with my dyslexia and all that stuff, reading is just not my forte.
Of course.
But then you've got Kate in the room and everyone's just really like lovely. You know, everyone's really, really lovely and welcoming and really everyone wants you to do well. That's something I always remind myself in any audition. They want you to be the person so they can stop looking. They don't want to fire you and have to look for another B15. So like, I remember that when I'm in those moments of high stress, like, no one wants this to not work. So they're actually all secretly wishing you well and wishing you do well. So I had to keep that in mind. And then honestly, like Kevin Feige walks in and I didn't know what he looked like.
Yeah.
And I had no idea this was Kevin Feige until like he kind of got up and like said, welcomed everyone. And I was like, oh, wow, this is the boss. Like, and he seems super chill. That's nice.
Yeah.
So it felt really intimidating until like I opened the door, basically.
Yeah, until you got in there and it was nice people working on cool stuff. That's kind
of
that's what you're looking for every time you open one of those doors.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, speaking of scripts, then with a script like this that's got so much jumping of like parallel realities and universes and time travel, how much of that do you try and get your head round, and how much do you just trust that the writers know what they're doing, and if you focus on your character, then that's all you need to do? Because it's, again, just watching a show like that, I'm always like, how was this written? It's so, there's so many levels and layers to tie together.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely try my best to understand everything. And then generally what I found happened, especially in, I'm just trying to think about season one was more of a linear story for my character. So like Kate walked me through the whole MCU from Loki arriving to season one, and then talked me through season one. And I, you know, that was a very, you know, specific journey for my character of like crisis of faith of, you know, and then like, you know, changing sides and realizing she's on the wrong side of history and trying to put that right. And then season two, that was confusing. And like there are things that are being introduced, like time ripping and time rippers and basically before most scenes we'd get like okay, this has happened in this universe, this hasn't happened in that universe, and this, like, you know, on this timeline. And like episode four was a bit of a boggle, to be honest. I feel like I have PTSD from that doing the same scenes over and over and over again. And then it was like, okay, this is this version of it. This is this version of it. And it was really hard. So yeah, I think like I try and understand as much as I can. And then the directors, they understand exactly where we're at. And then they put us straight. And Tom always knows where we're at. Like Tom is very much engaged and involved in the writing process and all that stuff. So he's like, this is exactly where we are on which timeline and which version of the TVA, past, present. Yeah, he's pretty good at that.
I love it. And I love the idea. And I don't want you to correct this in any way, but I in my mind, it's a scientist in a lab coat who's coming out at the beginning of each scene and explaining which timeline you're in. So here's where we are. Here's how this happened. This hasn't happened here, and this has happened there.
Yeah.
It makes it make perfect sense. Well, have you got any preference in working in America and in the UK, TV and film? Because you've done such a variation. So what's kind of, is there preference or is there differences, or is it good to have the variation?
For me, it's good to have the variation, especially between TV and film. Film feels a bit like more precarious in a way. Like sometimes you get cast in a film and then it never gets made.
Mm-hmm.
And so I get really like, I feel like quite anxious about films. So it's nice to know like with a TV show that it's definitely happening. Like you're only auditioning for something that is greenlit and happening.
Yeah.
And the UK versus the US, there's lots of things that I find great and frustrating about both. Personally, in the UK, I feel like everyone's more on an equal footing. Even if you're the lead, you know, everyone's kind of like in the same environment, and there's no like the star thing doesn't really come into play too much. Even on Loki, even though it's an American project and it's a big project, it feels like we're all kind of in it together in a way, even down to like trailers and stuff. Yeah. In the UK, generally, especially on TV, everyone's kind of in a similar size trailer. Yeah. Marvel's a little bit different, but but the first like eight actors are going to be in the same size trailer. Do you know what I mean? Like, and everyone else gets a nice trailer still. But in America, it can feel like only the big stars get the big trailers, and then everyone else gets like, it feels like sometimes, not on everything, but sometimes it feels like people can be in like tin cans, even if they have like speaking roles and stuff. So that kind of feels like, oh, that's a bit different. I like the way that the UK does it, because I feel like everyone feels like they're working together and working their way up together, and there's not like a huge difference between me and them and you and me. And yeah, so that's, I do like that. Just
there's more of a shared responsibility in that kind of atmosphere, isn't it? Like we're all responsible for this, rather than it's the lead show and we're just, you know, we'll go and do our job.
And then even then, like with Loki, like Tom was born and raised on British and trained in the British way. Yeah. So maybe that's why, it still doesn't feel like there's not a hierarchy that feels kind of really intimidating on Loki. Do you know what I mean? If he, you know, Tom feels like one of us rather than Tom over there, like who we can't talk to or don't look him in the eye. Do you know what I mean? But then I still feel like there's a lack of diversity behind the camera in the UK. Mm-hmm. Like I really, really found that quite obvious and quite jarring between season one of Loki, where we shot that in Atlanta, and season two, where we shot it in the UK.
Yeah.
And then, you know, even like I do feel like getting, you know, people of color for hair, makeup, costume on like, designing, not just like going off to get your hair braided. We want them on the bus too. They need to be part of the unions too. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I feel like that was a really big, it is a really big difference between the UK and the US. Mm. Is behind the camera, it's not as diverse all the way up from catering to our execs. Like in America, I have been pleasantly surprised. Like, you know, I started in the US. I did a pilot once, but then my first real big job in the US, other than I did Batman versus Superman, I can't really remember the crew so much on that as like, because I wasn't really like, I was kind of amazed that I was on this massive film. but you know, when like I'm on Lovecraft Country, I have a black showrunner, you know, I have a black first AD, I have a black cinematographer. It was like, wow, like hair and makeup was like, was black. Like I didn't have to like explain my hair to anyone, or, you know, camera crew.
How mad though that not having to explain your hair to someone feels like some kind of treat or some kind of unusual thing. That should be the norm. That shouldn't be.
It was such a kind of a, it was such a treat. And
that stands out. It's like that shouldn't,
but also women, like first of all, in Atlanta, I feel like on the hair and makeup truck, it was men and women designing and people of color. And not like it was mixed. It was, you know, we had a mixture of everyone. But on the camera crew and the sound department, there was always a woman on every single department.
Yeah.
And I did not find that in the UK. Like it feels very like, in On Passenger, I think we really did really well actually in regards to diversity, but it was something that we were very thoughtful about from the get-go. So I you know, to me, that was something that I came back to the UK saying, I need this. I need diversity. I need there to be a woman in sound as well as in camera, as in da-da-da. I need that. Like, I can't just be male and just white. Like, it can't be. And I feel like that can very easily happen in the UK. Especially outside of costume and makeup, it can just feel just like you're just surrounded by men.
Yeah. And that has to be a conscious activation of those changes, because the reality is because of the way the industry has been in the past, there will be loads more men applying for every job and being up for everything. So you have to consciously, it's not like, it annoys me when people argue, yeah, but it has to be the best person for the job. But it isn't currently the best person for the job, because it's a historical thing. There was certainly a point where it was openly very sexist or misogynistic or whatever else. Great, we're getting so away from that. But still, there's the history to dilute that and to switch that round. But let's talk a little bit about Lovecraft Country, because that's another one that meant a lot to me. Because in 2020, I was in Canada filming a TV show for 7 months, but during the pandemic, so in isolation, in an Airbnb. And Lovecraft Country was one of the shows that I want to say kept me sane, but maybe sent me more insane, because it's another made me think I was sane. But it's another wild show, right? So how was that to be part of? Because it's, again, it's a beautiful mix of things like horror and fantasy, but it's also making some amazing comparisons to the world that we're living in and the struggles, particularly at that point, all the things that were going on in the world. How was that to be part of, and how bonkers was it as a set? Because there's some, as you say, some mad stuff happens in that show.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of, I learned a lot on that show. I learned a lot. Like I said, it was my first like real job in America. Not real, sorry, I keep forgetting about my university, man. But like, it was my first like actual character.
It's so funny because I've written down, this was your first big American thing, and then I've noted, obviously you'd done Batman. Like, because again, I then looked, oh, obviously. So for some reason, I forgot that huge blockbuster of a film. But it was other than that,
like, it was like three scenes. So that's why I feel like that was my first big job. But it was like three scenes.
Yeah.
Whereas this is like my first job where I actually had like, you know, not just the character name, but like, and not more than five scenes. But I feel like I learned a lot. I learned a lot about American history, African American history, which obviously is American history, but also like, again, it was such a eye-opening experience to me, because I feel like that is a show that would never really get made in the UK, mm-hmm. because it was very much like in your face. This is the world we live in. This is the racism we experience. This is the inequality. But then also it was sci-fi, but the things to me that were more terrifying were not like the vampires and the it was the institutionalized, the systemic, the weight of racism and oppression. And I felt like I honestly just felt like my eyes were opened in a way, because I felt we have never done this in the UK. I didn't feel like we had, or we were bold enough to. And then I guess I found it made me feel frustrated and adamant and about like speaking up. You know, like I said, being on a makeup truck with people of color, being on a set with people of color and women, and I was like, oh, you know, this isn't what I'm used to, and why isn't this what I'm used to? That was just a personal thing.
Yeah.
A personal industry thing that I felt like I just didn't realize like how different my experience had been in the UK and how frustrating it had been in the UK until I was here. And then I was like, wow, this is so different. I need this to be the regular for home too. And then on set, I mean, it was heavy. It was a heavy piece. Like my character's journey was just like, it's very exposing, like it's just very exposing playing a black woman who takes a potion to be a white woman. It's a bit of a, can I swear? It's a bit of a head fuck.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like it is. And there's a lot to like unpack, and you have to kind of ask questions that you'd never ask these questions of yourself as a black woman, because there isn't a potion to take. And it was just quite exposing. It was very exposing, but quite wonderful to really actually delve into that psychology that those, oh, and, you know, it's been a while since, a long while since I've spoken about it. So it's kind of like trying to remember how I felt. I just remember feeling like, I felt like I had to look after baby, the child in me, in me who realized, like, who learned about inequality and beauty standards, and one of Ruby's lines is like, I'm just tired. She's tired of being interrupted. Her color is dark enough for white people to interrupt her living her life.
Mm.
And that was really, it triggered a lot in me because I realized how much I had done to make sure that to keep because of the interruption.
Yeah.
And even as a child, because of the interruption, because of the judgment, because of the, like, make sure you do this, you live like this so that you aren't interrupted as much as possible. And just living with the white gaze as a young child and having that form you into a woman is really, like, it's a painful realization. And Ruby very much made me realize that I hadn't quite seen the bends and the twisting myself into the shapes that the outside world needed me to be.
Yeah.
And until I did that show, until I was confronted with that character and her choice, because you teach yourself to love yourself, like, because the world doesn't feel so loving and warm. So you teach yourself, like, you must love yourself. You must be kind and loving to others and to yourself, and you must grow and be patient and kill with kindness. That's what my mom always says, kill with kindness.
Yeah.
And then it's like, then there's this potion. And you're like, wow, like, it's very confronting. Would I, woman, take that potion after all the work I've done on myself? No. That really is the answer. But would young woman have taken that potion when she was confronted with racism and inequality?
Mm.
Would she have? Probably. And so that show was very much about healing that little girl.
Yeah. It's fascinating to hear that. And I relate in kind of an unusual way, I guess, but hearing you talk about that, I've got a stammer and I'm perfectly comfortable with it. I do a lot of work trying to get more people to be comfortable with stammers, those who have and those who haven't. And I remember us being interviewed a while back about it. And again, you kind of get into your usual, here's the story, here's this, here's that. And at the end he asked, so you feel it's built who you are today, you're proud of what it's done. And then he asked, if you could get rid of it today, would you? And it was kind of it was almost an unintentionally horrible question, because I can't. So why are we having to look into this and think about this? It's like, I got it as a question, but it made me kind of go away going like, well, no, I hate the fact that there was part of me that was going, yeah, I would. Because again, I'm so proud and so comfortable with it. Just being confronted in that way did make me go, ah, damn. I hate that was in my mind. And again, hearing you talk about what this role did and this character did, I think we watch shows and we don't necessarily, if they're really good, we don't really think about the actors involved and what they've had to go through to portray this. Are you good at making sure you look after yourself and protect yourself when you're working, when you're in this industry, and making sure you're getting the self-care and aftercare needed when putting yourself in these dark places potentially?
I mean, I feel like I have been quite good at that. For me, Ruby was therapy.
Mm.
And then I got a therapist to kind of work, you know, to work through it again.
That but was I good. I should think, do more of that.
Yeah. And I think it should be offered, especially when it comes down to things of such personal and individual exploration and pain and unpacking. I think it should actually be offered with the job, that there should be someone to talk with. And actually, I think that was offered on Lovecraft because of the subject matter. Mm. I think it was actually offered. I think lots of actors struggle to disrobe fully when it is such a personal experience or like the journey you have to go on to become a character, I think it should be offered. That is, should be part, like now we have intimacy coordinators. Yeah. I do actually think there should be something, someone, a professional who can be accessed, you know, because also with Passenger, there is this small town mentality and, you know, she's an outsider and there are definite like, well, microaggressions. Mm-hmm. And as a Black woman in that world, you know, there's a scene with me and Joe Hartley and I'm like, oh, okay. Like this is what we avoid this, like that I'm the outsider and I'm different. And it could just be like, oh, you're from Manchester, we're from Chadder. But really it could also be a race thing too. Let's not. Yeah. And I think in the UK, we're very good at hiding things in microaggressions. And then, you know, that scene, I was a bit like, oh, okay. This is about race. Mm. This is about me not being here from here. This tiny little moment. And I don't know if Andrew wrote it like that, but in that moment for me and Rhea, I was like, oh, this is about me not being from here and not just about Chadder. Mm-hmm. It's for, I'm not, I think that's what she's saying. And that's how Rhea took it anyway.
Yeah.
And that's how I took it. And it was a small moment and it was a joyful set and it was a peaceful set. Thank goodness. But if it wasn't, if there was any tension between me and Joe, mm-hmm. if there was any other tensions on the set, that's when a scene like that can bring up a lot of pain for an actor. And there's no healing if you don't trust the other actor with you, if you don't trust the people around you. So I think it should be, I actually think it should be offered just on general practice.
Yeah. I mean, I'd kind of argue on certain projects, it should be mandatory in some way. There's a thing that the Samaritans do that when a Samaritan finishes their shift, they have to call a Samaritan who's off shift and offload to them. And it's just the act of saying, here's how my night's gone. And it allows you to not take it all home with you. So kind of on heavy storylines and things like that, I think a mandatory offload could be really important because a lot of us will just go, nah, it's just the job. And get on with it and go home. I wouldn't necessarily take offered therapy or offered anything deeper, but a mandatory kind of offload could be a really positive thing for people's mental health.
I agree. I totally agree. I know far too many people who have been injured by the characters they've played and the environments they've been put in for their art. And it's within the project. And it can also be outside of the project, outside of what's being filmed on set. How do I feel I'm being treated on this set? What is, you know, is everything okay? You know what I mean? Again, like I said, Passenger was pretty, I want to say it was pretty dreamy, very supportive set and crew and cast. So I forgot that's something I thought was needed because it felt safe.
Yeah.
And I felt like we could talk and I felt like other actors could talk to me and bring issues to me and I could bring them to the producers. But I do think that's something that should probably be considered on in the future for every show, just in case.
How did you find that responsibility then? Because I'm a big believer in the tone of a set is kind of set by the number one, number two, number three on the call sheet. It's those people at the top that really set if this is going to be a beautiful, joyous place to work or a tense place to work, like not even a bad place to work, but there can be huge variations. And having heard how you talk about working with Tom, did people like that influence how you want to, you know, have that outlook in the influence that whether you want that influence or not, you're going to have that influence on how the set feels?
Absolutely. Tom was definitely a great he is a great leader and a great like number one, and he's an exec, but he's an actual exec, like he does the work. It's not just by name. And I learned a lot from him about leading a set, and I thought the work that I had to do with Ruby was to stop playing small because I'm scared of people saying I'm an angry Black woman or da 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 da. I, you know, and being like, okay, if I am angry about something, I am allowed to say that. I am allowed to be, as long as I say it with compassion and kindness, and I'm not mean, you can say when something isn't working.
Yeah.
So I felt very much like I would happily be an advocate, just because it had taken me 32 years to realize that I needed to find my voice, and that I had been playing small because of I've been living with the white gaze. And I decided that I would make sure that I would speak up and be honest. As long as honesty is the only stop, I need to stop lying outside. Be honest, be respectful, mm-hmm. but be honest. And so I guess that was my 2021 New Year's kind of resolution thing, was like to be honest and stop hiding myself to try and make other people feel comfortable or whatever. So I made a very conscious effort of making sure I spoke to everyone. And if there was anything that they were unhappy with, that they felt like I was a safe place to say, and I could be an advocate on their behalf and be able to speak to the producers on behalf of the cast and crew. I mean, even if it was down to the catering, which did have to get mentioned a couple of times, like, you know, but as long as I said it with integrity and kindness, then I was like, I'm good. We're good. But I definitely learned a lot about leading a set from Tom. And I do think it comes from number one. I do. And I was determined that our set was going to be a nice, peaceful, joyful, artistic, creative set. That was something that I was really hopeful for. And I think we achieved it on Passenger. I think we did.
And let's
no one's going to be like, I had a miserable time.
No, but and let's face it, the catering is a key part of that. So again, people being comfortable to bring this up is because it can make a difference. If people are kind of grumpy ending each lunch break or going into it, then it can change things. So it can seem like a minor thing, but it's a huge thing. But I don't want to take up any more of your time. I appreciate you taking the time today. It's been an absolute joy to talk to you, and I'm excited for all this ahead.
Thanks so much, Bert. It was so lovely chatting to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Cheers. Have a lovely day.
You too.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Wumi Masaku. If you've not seen any of them shows, seek them out. Passenger is going out an episode at a time at the moment over on ITV. And you can obviously ITVX, that goodness, give it a look. I've only seen the first two and I'm excited to see the rest. So, yeah, wonderful stuff there. I'll be back next week. I mean, also just before, Scavenger's Reign is astounding. Loki, both series of Loki were astounding. Check them all out. If you somehow missed Lovecraft Country, go back and catch that weirdness. Yeah, that's enough of that. I'll be back next week with another fantastic guest, a music based guest. I'm not going to give anything away now, but it's a hell of a conversation. We talk music, we talk independent music, we talk the importance of the power of lyrics, the power of a message. We talk touring, we talk health, we talk politics, we talk life. It's a great episode. Next week, I'm telling you. So tune in at the same time. I'll be back then. Until then, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.